Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you here in San Francisco at the Marriott Hotel. I am Sunny McPeak, President of the Bay Area Council and your quarterly chair. We also welcome the listeners of KRSD-FM in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, one of more than 225 radio stations nationwide, joining us for America's longest-running radio program. We invite all of our listeners here in San Francisco and across the nation to visit us at our website at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now for today's speakers. We all know the legendary Charles Schwab, founder and chairman of the board of the Charles Schwab Company. You've seen him on television, listened to his sage, even fatherly advice, and learned how he manages his sister's portfolio. He started his San Francisco-based firm in 1971 as a traditional brokerage company, and in 1974 became a pioneer in the discount brokerage business, offering a combination of low prices with fast, efficient order executions, and soon became the nation's largest discount broker. Today, the firm serves over 5 million active investors, about as many as the second, third, and fourth largest discount brokers combined, with a nationwide network of over 278 branch offices. He was born here in California, in the state's capital, Sacramento, in 1937. He is a graduate of Stanford University, earning a BA in economics in 1959, and an MBA from Stanford Graduate School of Business in 1961. All of us would love to have Mr. Schwab give us investor advice today. However, we are going to hear from another facet of his life. The Schwab Foundation for Learning was started with a very personal struggle. The founders, Charles and his wife Helen, knew nothing about learning disabilities until their 8-year-old son was diagnosed as dyslexic. Just getting through the testing process with their son was exhausting. During one of those discussions, a school psychologist looked up and asked, "Didn't either of you have problems like this?" And that's when Charles Schwab, this wonderful pioneer in business, discovered his own dyslexia. Knowing that their bright son had dyslexia didn't make things any easier for the Schwabs. They had a name for this disability, but they didn't have the information to fight the battle. And that's when they founded their own family effort to help other parents. And in 1988, founded what has become the Schwab Foundation for Learning. Ladies and gentlemen, it's indeed a pleasure to introduce to you a business leader, a passionate parent and father, a civic servant, and certainly a community entrepreneur, Mr. Charles Schwab.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Sunny, those are magnificent words. I wrote them all down. I'm going to give them to my wife. I am indeed pleased at the turnout here for this subject matter. We're not going to talk about investments either. But our presentation today is a little bit of words from myself, and the part of the show that I'm really looking forward to is Dr. Sally and Bennett Shaywitz, who will be talking about some of their research and some of the ways we can deal with these issues. But I thought I would start off with a definition of it from my perspective. Dyslexia may seem to be such an unusual subject matter topic for the Commonwealth Club, but to my mind it makes a lot of sense. The Commonwealth Club is, of course, focused on issues of public concern that shape our world and, of course, our future. And the issue of learning differences is one of the most critical issues, in my mind, that we face in our educational system today. People who are passionate about an issue usually have a personal reason for that interest. And, of course, I'm no exception, as Sunny mentioned. As a child, schoolwork for me, never came easily. It was reading and writing were particularly difficult. Math I was pretty good at. but reading and writing, no way. I had a hard time decoding words, and I didn't know why at the time. I didn't know that I had to work so hard. I'd worked three times harder than most of the other kids to accomplish the same thing. Particularly, reading was my issue. Fortunately, I had supportive teachers and supportive parents who helped me focus on my strengths. And I had another great secret. I had classic comic books. I can't imagine how I could have gotten through those early years of school without reading those things like Ivanhoe and Moby Dick, without the classic comic books. I don't know if they still publish them, but they were certainly terrific. That was about 50 years ago that all happened. And in 1987, when my youngest son, was diagnosed with a learning problem called dyslexia, it was only then that I learned myself the name for my own reading difficulty, and the thing finally made some sense. And research tells us that while learning problems aren't contagious, they are genetic. My son inherited his dyslexia from me, and it's something he will have for all of his life because it's not something he outgrow. I'm 61, and I'm still dealing with it. The Wall Street Journal is one thing I know like the back of my hand because I'm immersed myself in it every day, and I know the language of business pretty well now, thank God. But when I go on vacation, which I'm going to do next week, I'll be packing along this copy of Shogun that's really pretty tattered. For the 10th time, I'll try to get through part of that. I'm still working on it. It may take me another 10 years to get through Shogun. It's an unbelievable challenge. Dyslexia and other learning problems are indeed a lifelong struggle. Learning differences are a pervasive issue, I think, for our children and our schools. The research that Sally and Bennett Deshewitz will indicate to you and have done work on and published on indicates that 1 out of 5 kids have a learning problem. 1 out of 5. In a classroom of 30 kids, that means at least 6 of them learn and process differently than the other 80%. But because curriculums are often designed in a one-size-fit-all, that 20% of the classroom can fall through the cracks and ultimately fall out of the educational system altogether. The result is that those kids suffer the consequences of an incomplete education. They come out with limited literacy, lower self-esteem throughout their whole lives, and society suffers because of that and suffers along with them. Let me cite a few statistics that I think will underscore the problem and maybe the potential. 30% of adolescents with learning disabilities will be arrested 3 to 5 years out of high school. It's a big number. The rate of unemployment for students with learning disabilities 2 years out of school is twice that of students in the general population. This is an interesting number. Nearly 60% of adolescents in treatment for substance abuse have learning disabilities. 60%. And that's usually because of self-esteem has sort of been harmed along the way. This is a needless waste of ability and promise because research also tells us clearly that children with learning differences can reach their full potential because they have normal or above average raw intelligence. But they need help. They need help in identifying their learning differences, and they need help in proper instructions. They need to learn compensation strategies, and they need to receive motivation and support all along the way. Parents and teachers need help too. And I know that as a parent, my wife and I had tremendous difficulties locating resources when we found out our child had the problem. It's hard to believe that with a problem as common as learning differences, parents and educators are often at a loss as to where to go for help. So that's why some 10 or so years ago, my wife Helen and I started a foundation to support the parents of support the parents of children with learning differences. And I think we help about 1,000 families a month now down our San Mateo office. You're all welcome to come. The foundation does provide information and guidance. We felt we could help parents and teach parents that in a 30-minute presentation, 30-minute introduction about the issues of learning differences, what it took us about 3 years to pick up. It just, the information wasn't readily available back then. It's getting more so today. Parents everywhere can now receive information and individual support and expert guidance on learning differences now, regardless of their income and regardless of where they live. Through our website and toll-free number, parents have a direct line to specialists who can provide information and answers about learning differences, either by email or, of course, by telephone. And they can find the personal support that gives them hope for the child's future. The Schwab Foundation for Learning website also includes sections specifically for teachers, including a database of lesson plans and teaching strategies for reaching all students, especially those struggling with learning problems. In the information and materials we make available to parents and teachers, perhaps nothing is more compelling than the research into the brain. It's through this research that we are learning how to recognize learning differences, how to teach kids, how to teach them how to compensate for their problems, and how important early intervention is. And with me today are two leading experts I'm having the pleasure to introduce. They are experts in the field of reading and dyslexia. They are going to share with us their fascinating discoveries in learning how the brain works in both good and poor readers. But before I relinquish this podium, I'd like to say one more thing to all parents and teachers in the audience today, as well as those listening to this radio broadcast. If you think your child or student may have a learning problem, log on to schwablearning.org or call 1-800-230-0988 to reach the Schwab Foundation for Learning. End of the commercial. But it is non-for-profit. Now I'd like to introduce the Dr. Schawitzes. Dr. Sally Schawitz is professor of pediatrics at the Yale University School of Medicine. She joined the Yale faculty in 1979 as founder and director of the Learning Disorder Unit in the Department of Pediatrics. Her body of work has provided the fundamental framework for an informed public policy on reading and dyslexia. Her husband, Dr. Bennett Schawitz, is professor of pediatrics and neurology at the Yale University School of Medicine. He has devoted his career to understanding the basic neurobiology of reading and dyslexia and the mechanics and mechanisms underlying disorders, attention disorders. Together, they are the co-directors of the Yale Center for the Study of Learning and Attention. Please welcome Dr. Sally and Bennett Schawitz.
Thank you. Can you all hear me? What Charles Schwab has just told you about his own personal story dovetails precisely with what science is teaching us about dyslexia. Based on new scientific discoveries, we now understand why someone like Charles Schwab can be both extremely bright and also dyslexic. For over a century now, the paradox of dyslexia has intrigued, frustrated, and challenged scientists. In our society, reading ability is taken as a proxy for intelligence. We assume that if a person is smart, he will learn to read. And we also accept the corollary. If someone has difficulty in reading, why he can't be so smart? Dyslexia violates this assumption. In dyslexia, some very smart people have trouble learning to read. Fortunately, scientific research is now providing answers to why even the brightest of people may have trouble learning to read. Children are our most precious resource. They epitomize our hopes and our dreams for ourselves and for the future of our country. hopes and dreams that come to an abrupt halt for millions of children who, despite Herculean efforts, cannot learn to read because of dyslexia. There is not a family in this country that has not been touched by a reading disability in some way. For millions of American children, a reading disability has extinguished the light of childhood. By uncovering the very basis of dyslexia and the core deficit responsible for reading failure, research discoveries have brought us, for the very first time in history, to the threshold of interrupting the cycle that begins with reading failure and has consequences beyond school and beyond childhood. Such progress is remarkable for our country in terms of lost resources regained and for each child in terms of a life reclaimed. These remarkable discoveries have come about through a targeted program of research initiated by the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. This story of the journey of dyslexia from a vague and often poorly understood entity to a disorder on the cutting edge of neuroscience represents the best example of just what can be accomplished when parents, committed citizens, and policymakers work together for a common societal goal. It is the true story of science, citizens, and government serving the public interest. What have we learned? How far have we come? I want to share with you what we have learned about the science of reading. Discoveries that have emerged from a sharply focused program of research designed to address three critical questions. First, beginning from the broadest perspective, how many children are affected, and what happens to these children over the course of development? Once we are able to identify exactly who these children are, scientists can then focus on the next level of inquiry, and that is, second, what is the basic or core deficit responsible for dyslexia? That is, what is the specific cognitive deficit that is preventing reading from occurring? And third, at the most basic level, can we identify the underlying brain mechanisms themselves, the specific neural systems that are responsible for dyslexia? This question, the most fundamental question of all, addresses the most abstract and yet most compelling issue facing researchers. How does the mind work? What is the relationship between mind and matter, between thinking or reading and brain structure and function? It is very exciting indeed to be able to tell you today that substantial progress has been made in addressing each of these questions in turn. Extraordinary changes take place across the period of childhood. One of the most extraordinary is that children learn to read. The Connecticut Longitudinal Study was initiated in 1983 to chart the course of development in a large, randomly selected group of kindergartners. This group of 445 school children has now been carefully monitored for their entire span of their schooling. Results now indicate that dyslexia is a very common disorder, affecting at least 10 million children, or approximately one child in five. Data from the longitudinal study, too, indicate that not only is dyslexia common, it is persistent. Reading disability does not go away, but represents an enduring deficit that remains with the child from the beginning of school through high school and beyond. We now know not only that dyslexia persists, but just what it is that remains with the child and prevents him from learning to read. Converging evidence from many laboratories indicates that it is the language system that is responsible for reading. Reading reflects language. Furthermore, we now know that the core deficit responsible for dyslexia is at the most basic or lowest level of the language system, the phonology, which has to do with the processing of the sounds of language. Children and adults with dyslexia have difficulties with this most basic step in the reading pathway, breaking down the written word into simpler sound units. As a result of this deficit, children cannot break the reading code. The discovery of the phonologic basis of reading disability allows us to understand why even some very bright individuals cannot learn to read. In contrast to this lower level deficit in getting to the sounds of language, the higher order language skills, the cognitive equipment involved in reading comprehension and meaning, are generally not impaired in dyslexia. Thus, we have the paradox of an encapsulated lower level deficit surrounded by what I like to refer to as a sea of strengths in higher order thinking. Strengths in problem solving, reasoning, critical thinking, concept formation, and vocabulary. The phonologic model crystallizes exactly what dyslexia is all about. Children with good intelligence who cannot use their often excellent higher order cognitive skills because of a block in the first step of the reading pathway. This model of an encapsulated, circumscribed deficit surrounded by a sea of strengths now provides a template for an approach to dyslexia. We want to remediate the deficit, but we want to also ensure that the dyslexic reader can access his often superior higher order reasoning skills. So dyslexia is not only about deficits, but about strengths as well. We have now entered a new and extraordinary era in the study of dyslexia. Up until recently, scientists were very limited in how we could study the basic neural mechanisms serving reading. The bony skull, so important in protecting the brain, also obscures its contents. The challenge, how to peer inside the brain without disturbing it. And an even greater challenge, not only to peer within the brain, but to see it at work. It is now possible to observe the working brain as a child reads, thinks, or remembers. A wonderful new technology, functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI, makes it possible to image the working brain. Using this technology, we at Yale and scientists at labs all around the world have now succeeded in describing the neural architecture for reading. The neural circuitry for reading is no longer a secret. For many years, dyslexic children and adults have suffered because of the invisible nature of dyslexia. It is truly a hidden disability. Their problems reading, the blows to their self-esteem, are all invisible to the outside world. Dyslexic readers have had little hard evidence to show for all their difficulties. Because these dyslexic readers are often so bright, they are sometimes accused of not trying hard enough or of not being motivated enough when they are working harder than most of their peers. Our dream always was to uncover hard evidence of the difficulty in dyslexia. Imaging provided the ideal means. In a study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in 1998, we reported such evidence. Imaging a group of good readers and poor readers, we observed a disruption, a glitch, in the brain wiring for reading in dyslexic readers. As good readers sounded out words, the neural circuitry for reading in the back of the brain literally lit up and popped into action. In poor readers, these same circuits remained silent, out of commission. Finally, here it was, hard evidence of the reality suffered by so many dyslexic readers, incontrovertible evidence of the fundamental neurologic nature of dyslexia. No longer would dyslexic readers have to be told that their poor reading was their imagination or due to a lack of motivation. Dyslexia leaves its mark in the brain. there is now a neural signature for dyslexia. Just as a child with a broken arm can show an X-ray of his injury, a dyslexic can point to an fMRI to document that there is indeed a disruption in the circuitry for reading in dyslexia. Dyslexia is real. We believe that this is only the beginning. Imaging studies now underway in our lab are using this knowledge to assess the effectiveness of treatment programs for reading. We can measure the imprint of the intervention. Does it take root in the brain? Does it strengthen the circuitry for reading? Does the intervention work? Does it have to be modified? Advances in imaging have the potential to identify children earlier and with more precision, and to develop and tailor more effective and lasting interventions for dyslexia. It is truly a new day. What does this all mean? It means that each of us has a moral obligation to put this new knowledge of reading to work. No child should have to struggle when we have learned so much about reading. There is nothing as sad and as wasted as knowledge that is not put to work. We now have an extraordinary opportunity, and we must take advantage of it. There are 10 million children in this country who are struggling to read. We can and we must identify each of these children, and we must make sure that the gifts of modern neuroscience are used in their behalf. True, all the answers are not yet in, but we know enough to make a real difference in the lives of millions of children. We must now work hard to ensure that this incredible and powerful knowledge is actually put to work to help children. Each day, I receive calls from distraught parents. Can you help my child? Can you help her to read? Today, it is not so much that we don't know, but that we are failing to use the knowledge of reading that we have. The Schwab Foundation has provided the dynamic leadership to ensure that this exciting and yet practical information is available to every parent and to every educator. I encourage you to contact the Foundation for Learning or their website to get help. Knowledge is truly power. Last year, I appeared on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer to talk about our discovery of the miswiring in dyslexia. Back in my hotel room, I received a call from one of my colleagues in New Haven. With great excitement and great passion, he said, "That was me you were talking about. That was me you were describing. As I heard you speak, there were tears streaming down my cheeks." Here was a senior faculty member from my own institution telling me how he could not read until he was 12 years old, and how he continues to be an extremely slow reader to this day. A gifted surgeon, renowned for his skill, he told me he still never reads for pleasure, still struggles to read and to pronounce words. Just as dyslexia impacts reading, it also affects speaking. A dyslexic has no trouble with the meaning of words, but he may have difficulties retrieving the exact words he wants to say. Knowing that dyslexic readers have trouble accessing the sound structure of both spoken and written words helps paint a portrait of dyslexia, a person who has difficulties reading words, particularly unknown or long unfamiliar words. The dyslexic relies on the context around a word to get to the meaning of a word he can't read. For an adult dyslexic, context is a lifeline because it allows him to figure out the meaning of a word that he can't read. As a result, dyslexic readers are disproportionately penalized by standardized multiple choice tests, which provide scanty context. In contrast, dyslexic readers have strengths in reading comprehension. They are excellent conceptualizers and big-picture creative thinkers. Dyslexic readers often violate our stereotypes of who is smart. As a result of their disability, they read slowly, often mispronounced words, and scored dismally on standardized tests. Their skills and their strengths are often in the more difficult to measure, and yet I would argue ultimately far more important areas of thinking, reasoning, problem solving, and creating. And that is why so many of our leaders in business, in law, in science, in journalism, and even Nobel laureates in medicine are indeed dyslexic. My husband believes that the same brain area we discovered to not work for reading may instead be reserved in dyslexic readers for a higher function, creativity. And we hope to be able to image creativity someday soon. This pattern in dyslexia of a lower level deficit surrounded by a sea of strengths presents a real challenge to us as a society. I have spoken to many highly successful dyslexic men and women, and what is remarkable is the similarity of their stories. They were only able to gain access to college or professional schools by a fluke. They had to go around the system. The school wanted to recruit someone from a particular high school or region, or someone with a particular athletic skill, or they were fortunate their family knew someone. Generally, their scores on standardized tests were so low that they were not considered, quote, good candidates. They did not fit the desired profile. Let me close with one of these stories of an acclaimed physician, someone each one of us would want to see if we had a complicated illness. Dr. R. was rejected from 10 out of 11 medical schools to which he applied, something about low standardized test scores. Since that time, he has gained an extraordinary reputation as a brilliant and compassionate physician. He has been offered the chair of virtually every school that rejected him, and now he is the one turning each of them down. Not too long ago, he was asked to deliver an address at his alma mater. The topic he chose? Failure. He said failure was something he knew a lot about. This true story captures so much of what dyslexia is all about. Extraordinary gifts and high potential. But it also tells us about the enormous cost to individuals, about how much a dyslexic individual endures along the way. Success in life is all about access. And for so many dyslexic young men and women, access is denied based on stereotyped views, misguided profiles of who is likely to succeed. I worry, and we as a society should all worry, about the enormous potential talent that is being lost because the next Charles Schwab is denied access to Stanford or to Yale or to the profession of his choice because he scores poorly on multiple choice tests. We are too good and wise a society to let the potential of a person be obscured by standardized test scores and deny a capable person access because he is dyslexic and is penalized by such tests. We must re-examine our selection processes. Standardized tests predict best to one thing only, performance on other standardized tests. As Charles Schwab recently told me, why would I ever look at test scores in hiring someone? I want to know about their qualities, their drive, their motivation, their interest, their capacity to think and to do the job, something a test score could never capture. Science has taught us so much about dyslexia, an encapsulated deficit surrounded by a sea of strengths. We as a society now have a choice to define people by their deficits or to recognize and to allow young men and women to access their strengths and to be given the opportunity to dream and to reach their potential just like anyone else. As a result of scientific discoveries, we now understand the true heart and soul of dyslexia. The challenge is, are we up to using this wonderful knowledge to help children and young adults? I think we are. I hope so. Thank you.
Thank you. Charles Schwab, founder and chairman of Charles Schwab & Company, and Dr. Sally Shaywitz, professor of pediatrics at Yale University, who is accompanied by Dr. Bennett Shaywitz, also professor of pediatrics and neurology at Yale, for your presentation here today. At this time, Dr. Watchin Leitch, professor emeritus, UC Berkeley, and a member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Directors, will moderate our question and answer session. Dr. Leitch.
Thank you. Thank you, Sonny McPeak, our quarterly chair. Dr. Shaywitz and Mr. Schwab, we have a lot of questions for you, so we'll get right into them. And I encourage you to all pitch in. Hopefully there might even be a little disagreement occasionally, and we can have a good discussion. So a number specifically for Mr. Schwab. How has your experience informed your view of the so-called meritocracy? Has it given you insight into other types of disadvantages that may not be fully recognized, that is, non-genetic environmental factors, etc.?
Well, I guess we're speaking about in the workplace, and I know at our company we have about 14,000 employees, and we try to make it an institution with, about diversity in many respects. And I encourage my people, it's not only just about color of skin or religion, it's also those people who might suffer some of the same things I have suffered in terms of learning differences. Because I think there's an aspect of creativity, and our company really tries to make an effort in creativity and innovate. And so we never ask people about what they test on their SAT scores or what was the grade point average 20 years ago, or those kinds of things are never come into conversation in our company. So maybe that's about meritocracy. I don't know.
Thank you. A couple of rather personal ones. Were you a victim of ridicule as a young student, and at what speed can you read now compared to the norm, and have you been able to increase your speed?
I'm still a very slow reader. I, because I spend a lot of time on one subject matter, which is business, which is pretty boring to some people, but not to me, I can read pretty fast and decode the words quite quickly. But I never, like Dr. Shaywitz mentioned, I never read a novel for pleasure. Unfortunately, I read a lot of magazines and things of that nature. My reading speed is still quite slow.
This is one for a number of you. How adept are today's teachers at spotting dyslexia compared to when Mr. Schwab was in school? That was just a few years ago, by the way.
50.
Well, I think it really varies. I think teachers really are into teaching because they want to try to help children. We've had this explosion of knowledge, and we're in the process of trying to disseminate what we've learned with varying degrees of success. I think one of the really important things is to be able to have an asset like the Schwab Foundation for Learning to which teachers and parents can turn and learn what do we know? Where is the new knowledge? So I think things are really getting better. But, of course, if you have a child who's in school, you want to make sure that their teacher is the one that really is aware of this new knowledge.
For Mr. Schwab, besides classic comic books, what factor do you think contributed to your ability to preserve your self-esteem and success in higher learning? How did your parents feel about your reading difficulties? Would you comment on that?
Well, back then, 50 years ago, the word dyslexia really wasn't used that I was aware of, I don't think. My compensations were in other areas. I was pretty good in my relationship, in my communication skills with teachers. I was sort of a leader of the class different times. I was quite good in athletics. I really spent a lot of time in that, so I maintained my self-esteem there. But when I got down to the period at night when I do my homework, particularly on reading, I was great at math also, but when I had to read something, it was a real struggle. And what was really worse, when I had to write something, I really struggled. I didn't really write my first good paper until I was in graduate school at Stanford. Sorry to say. Some of my teachers might be out there.
Would you like to comment, Dr. Shaywitz, on how any of these issues?
Well, I think that in the case of Charles Schwab, we have this wonderful example of someone who's very bright but has a reading difficulty and who has these other wonderful strengths and can use them to try to do and follow his dreams and his potential, which he's done, and to preserve his self-esteem at the same time.
All right, we'll get back to the economics. Is there an estimate of the cost of lost productivity in the U.S. economy due to learning difficulties?
I suppose you're directing that question to me, Mac. Thank you. I haven't measured it, but it is enormous. When you get into the numbers like 60% of adolescents that are faced with drug abuse and alcohol abuse, it's enormous cost. I mean, it's just... You can't even calculate what it is, the loss to themselves, to society. And you go beyond that. If it's 1 in 5, and when we talk about 1 in 5, as Dr. Shaywitz mentioned in her talk, I'm sure it's maybe a very small fraction of the 1 in 5 even gets sort of discovered. People sort of pass through life, and they sort of think they're not particularly smart or swift or something, and so their self-esteem, and they never maximize their potential. It's really incalculable, in my opinion.
We have a number of questions concerning the testing for dyslexia. One, the recognition that it might exist, let's say, on the part of a teacher. Testing for it, how do they do it, what does it cost, and then what can teachers do about it once it's been established?
That's quite a question. I think what is really wonderful about the new knowledge is that it's I like to refer to it as being organic. It really relates to what you can see and notice about children. So what a teacher or a parent can do is to think of an encapsulated deficit surrounded by a sea of strengths, and you can look at all different ages for evidence, for example, of difficulties getting to the sound structure of language. A child at a young age who has delayed speaking, who has trouble hearing rhymes, who has trouble pronouncing words. Those sorts of things are really good indications, even at a young child. And we can further support that because now they're becoming available more and more specific tests that assess a child's abilities in this area. But I would want to say that there's no magic in an assessment process. It really requires a very good clinician who synthesizes a range of information. Information from a parent that tells us about what this child has been like, what his speech has been like, his language has been like, his struggles with both reading and writing and even spoken language. And then there may be tests that you can give too, but there's not one single test or one single score that we look to. It's really putting together a host of information. And I think what the important thing is now, because we understand the basic nature of dyslexia, it's not like a Chinese menu, one from this column and one from that column. We really can select pieces of a child's developmental history and testing that makes sense, that together form a picture of someone who is struggling to access the sounds of language.
Would the other Dr. Shaywitz like to comment on this?
Well, I let me amplify to say that there are a lot of clues that can help you if you're a parent and you're looking at your child. One clue is Mr. Schwab was talking about, is that if in fact this is something that a parent had as a child, then there's then that's something that you as a parent should worry about in your own children. A family history is very, very important. The other issue is I think that just to amplify on what Sally was saying, there really is no single test. There is a constellation of findings, this difficulty getting to the sounds of words, and it differs in young children to some degree compared to, for example, adolescents and young adults. By the time someone gets to be a young adult and they've compensated enough for their dyslexia to get into a college or a graduate school, those young adults are going to be reading words well enough so that a test might be very misleading. If you give them a standardized test, you'll say, gee, this person reads well. But what you won't understand and is that they're reading with a terrible cost. They're reading with a tremendous amount of effort. The speed at which they're reading, when reading for most of us is so automatic, in fact, for these young adults, it's not automatic. And yet, these young adults come up against a barrier often. They are told that, for example, we see many young adults who are trying to become lawyers the bar will say, no, you can't have extra time on this test, and because you read words so accurately, but in fact they don't read words very quickly. And we know many people who are very accomplished lawyers and jurists who are severe dyslexic and who tell us that reading slowly is not a problem. They just spend longer at it. And so what I would encourage you is to remember that, particularly in young adults, the picture may be very different than it is in a child, where it's easy to say, "Oh, a young child who's not reading words at a certain accuracy is having a problem." And by the time someone gets to law school, things will be very different, and the diagnosis might be a little more subtle.
We have a number of "is there a connection" questions. Is there any difference between genders? Is there any relationship to left-handedness? Is there any connection with color blindness? And is there any connection with athletic ability?
Okay, well, we'll test my own memory in remembering each of those. It used to be thought for quite a long time that dyslexia affected primarily boys. And that becomes very important because if you think a problem particularly affects one group, that's who you look for it in. And that's who you identify, and then it becomes part of people's experience. Well, every person that I ever saw who was dyslexic was a male, so that's who it must affect. A few years ago, we actually did a study to try to get a better understanding. And we were able to use a population of children that we were following in what's called the Connecticut Longitudinal Study, because these were children not who were identified because they had a reading problem, but just a large group of children. And what we did was we asked the schools for each child, who have you identified as having a reading problem? And what we found was the schools identified 4 times as many boys compared to girls. But we were able to do something else. Because we tested each child, we were able to apply the guidelines that the schools were using. And what we found was that there was no difference in the prevalence of reading problems in boys and girls. And I guess you don't need to be a rocket scientist to figure out the difference. We looked at our data and said, well, how can we account for this? And what happened was, of course, the schools were identifying boys because they were more rambunctious. They were causing more problems. They were speaking out. And that may be a problem, but it may not be a reading problem. And so I think that the take-home message from that was that little girls who can be sitting very politely and quietly in their seats may also have a reading problem. So that reading problems affect girls as well as boys, and we must really be vigilant and not overlook girls who may be very sweet and sitting very quietly but also not learning to read. Let me just take one more of those, the issue of left-handedness. That also had been believed for many years, but more recent studies trying to assess is there an increased incidence of left-handedness in dyslexia have not supported that view. There may be some subgroups of people with reading problems who have a higher incidence of left-handedness, but if you look at the total population of people who are having trouble reading, you wouldn't find an excess of people who are left-handed.
We have a number of questions concerning the ability of teachers to recognize the symptoms of dyslexia once recognized, being able to do anything about it, and indeed, what is being done nationally in the schools to accommodate, recognize and accommodate these students?
Well, I think there's an enormous interest in trying to bring research into the classroom. And particularly the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development has taken the leadership in supporting research that actually examines what works. What works better? We've come to an age that we don't have to rely on anecdotal information and say, well, that sounds good. There's actually now developing a core of information, of evidence, that helps us assess what works. And what we're learning is that what works in teaching children to read is to teach them about how our language system works, to teach them how to listen and hear that words come apart into pieces, and that letters represent these bits of language. So if you take a word like bat, children have to become aware that this spoken word can be divided up into what we call phonemes, little bits of sound, so that the word bat has three phonemes, b, a, and t. And all the words in the English language, both spoken and written, can be broken up into these bits of sound. And that's how our language system works. Picture them as little blocks. If you want to say a word, you have to get those little blocks out of your mind and put them together. And in order to read, you have to understand that these words can be broken up into parts. And an example I like to use is a child was once coming out of an optician's office, and he had just gotten new glasses. And he looked across the street, and he said, "Oh, my goodness, that building has bricks. I'd always seen it as sort of a smush of red." And the same way, children have to hear that words aren't just some big holistic entity, but that they have parts, that letters represent these parts, and that the number of sounds in a word, in the written word, is the same as in a spoken word. So that's called the alphabetic principle, and that's what children need to learn in order to learn how to read. And now there's increasing evidence supporting the fact that children need to learn this and at the same time become aware of the literature and be able to enjoy stories and develop their vocabulary.
Children learn to speak, but they must be taught to read. We did not evolve with reading as we did with speech. Isn't the proper question, why don't more of us have problems with learning reading? I think you can all three take a whack at that one.
Well, that's a very interesting question, and it's a very nice statement. In fact, that's what every people who've studied language and reading have come to believe. People have been speaking as long as there have been people, and their disagreement is it 100,000 years or is it 1,000,000 years? But certainly, speaking is built into our genes as people. But reading is only relatively recent. It's only a few thousand years old, maybe 5,000 years. So, in fact, it's not surprising that learning to read is so difficult for so many people. It's something that's not built into our genes. There are many, I mean, the estimates are that there are 20%, some people say 30%. There's one national survey that indicated that 40% of children are not reading up to what they should be. So it is very common. I think the question really captures the reason that it's such a problem is that we are not, humans were not built to read, but we were built to speak.
As we learn more about the brain, are there any possible interventions that are on the horizon that would help in this area?
Go ahead.
Well, I think we're learning about the brain, not so much that we're looking for an intervention to go in and tinker with the brain, but more to understand what the basic nature of the problem is, and then to be able to study the effects of different interventions on the brain and see if they really take hold, if they really take root. And the ability now to be able to image the brain as someone reads is extraordinary. I mean, you could see where the difficulties is, and we believe, and we're in the process of investigating this now, to actually see what does teaching a child in one specific way, what does it do to those brain systems Does it strengthen them? Does it cause a new path to be formed? These are wonderful questions, and I think the exciting thing is we can actually begin to answer them.
Are there any advances in technology that are helping people with dyslexia? Are there computer programs or other learning technology programs being developed?
Well, I think those are just beginning to be developed. There are programs to teach children on the computer, and I think what's very helpful to children and young adults who have reading difficulties is to be able to hear, to have, for example, Recordings for the Blind puts out wonderful tapes. There are now reading machines. I think it would be even a greater advance if we had something that was really easy to use, that people who had reading difficulties could take in a portable way and use, so it was accessible and it was portable. I'm sure people are working on this, but I don't think there's anything like that available now.
I'd just say books on tape are a fantastic way to for kids to learn and for adults to learn. I use them all the time, and I wish I'd had them when I was 10 or 11 years old. As a matter of fact, someone sent me a Shogun on tape, so don't.
I use books on tape all the time myself, and I have no problem with reading. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. We have time for just one last question, and I know you came here to hear about dyslexia, but we want a little frosting on the cake. And Mr. Schwab, while you're on vacation next week, would you care to tell us what might happen to the market?
Thank you, Mac. What an opportunity. The market is going to go up and down.
Now you understand why he was so successful in Stanford's economic department. Our thanks to Charles Schwab, chairman of Charles Schwab & Company, Dr. Sally Shaywitz, professor of pediatrics at Yale University, and Dr. Bennett Shaywitz, professor of pediatrics and neurology at Yale University, for speaking here today. We also thank our audience here in San Francisco, as well as those listening on radio, for joining us. We invite you to return soon. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the nation's oldest continuous public affairs forum, is adjourned.